ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Filmmakers often depict war through the eyes of children. In the new movie from Turkish-German director Fatih Akin, a young boy living on an island off the coast of Germany in the final days of World War II is as innocent as most other boys. But his parents are not. They're committed Nazis. And in these final moments of the war, he will start to see them differently. Hi, I'm Jason DeRosso. Welcome to another episode of The Screen Show on ABC Radio National. Fatih Akin's new film is called Amrum, and it's set on the flat, sparsely populated island of Amrum off the German coast. It's a far-flung place, not really touched by the war, until now. The arrival of starving German refugees fleeing the Soviet army are a shocking sight, and British bombers roaring in from the sea are daily reminders of the Allied advance. But the boy's most pressing concern is his mother, who's heavily pregnant and suffering dramatic mood swings. He's unaware that her deteriorating mental health is because, for her, the end of the war is a looming disaster. He thinks he can help her if he brings her her favourite food, white bread and honey. But the ingredients to make the bread, not to mention the honey, barely exist under wartime austerity. Still, he sets out to find them. Amrum is a morally complex film that presents a fracturing world via a fable about a boy on a quest, trundling along muddy fields, knocking on doors, following his own sense of simple duty. Rossellini tried something similar in Germany Year Zero. Along the way, a series of encounters, some with adults who have very different views from the boy's mother and are beginning to voice them, are like small pieces of a puzzle coming together. The screenwriter, the late filmmaker Hark Bom, wrote the script from his own childhood memories. Before he died, he entrusted the telling of this story to his friend, director Fatih Akin, who's coming up next.
Ich kann auch nicht dafür, was meine Eltern getan haben.
Zerstören. Immer nur zerstören.
Verfliehen!
Sie wissen, was auf der Kraftzersetzung steht.
Was machst du hier, mitten in der Nacht in der Prärie?
Ich schau nach Falken.
Einen Watt magerst du, wenn du Höcken schaust?
Bin ich gebannt.
Fatih Akin, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about the genesis of this project, because it involves a very personal connection that you have to another filmmaker.
Yes, the whole project is based on the memories of Hark Bom, who was my former film professor in film school. And Hark was a known and respected filmmaker from the 70s and 80s in Germany. And he was my teacher, and later he became my friend and my co-worker. So we wrote several projects of mine together. He was acting in one of my films, and he wanted to do this film based on his memories about his parents who were Nazis and when he was a child. And I supposed to be the producer of the project. And I found him money to write and for the development. But he was sick. He was kind of 82 when he started the project. And 2 years before I was shooting the project, he said to me, "I can't do it. I want you to make it." You know, which was an offer I couldn't resist. I heard me saying yes, but I didn't understand why I did so. So I had to grow in the project. It felt, I mean, I felt very comfortable and safe while I was producing the whole thing. But producing and directing is very different things. And once I was the director on that, it took me a while to understand what this film is really about, to understand what could be my personal connection to the material.
So tell me about how you get in the head, or how you get into the story, how you get your head into this story. You know, you come from a migrant Turkish background. You've lived and grown up in Hamburg, made films in Hamburg, made films about the Turkish migrant experience. So how do you get your head around what it was like to be German during World War II as a child and have Nazi parents?
I thought a lot about the relationship I had with my father. That was kind of key to get into the material. My father and I had very different political opinions, especially about Turkey. So many friends of mine in Turkey are in prison. They are in prison because of the people where my father was voting for, you know. So my father and I, we couldn't speak for 10 seconds about politics. It became so loud that we were hurting each other and everybody else in the room. But he was my father and I loved the guy, you know. He was a good father. So we decided to not talk about politics anymore. So that was the one thing I would like to make a film about that. So Ammon gives me the opportunity to make a film about something I had experienced in another way, in another time, in another system, but the mechanics are the same, right? The other thing was, I'm a big city person. I'm not really a nature guy, you know, but I remember every summer for the big holidays, for the long holidays, we went to Turkey when I was a child. My parents both came from the Black Sea, from different places, but the family of my father, they were fishermen. And I was fishing the whole summer. So I knew about fishing. I knew about boats. I knew about nature. I knew about it's too windy to go fishing and stuff. You know, I knew about how to work with nets for fishing. So all these experiences helped me to feel the world I was creating. And, you know, Turkey always was, I think until the 2010s or something, always a bit behind Germany, you know, in terms of technic or whatever, infrastructure. Let's say until 2000, you know, I would say 20 years. When I would remember the early 80s, it felt like early 60s maybe in Germany. And from that on, you are not too far from the Second World War, you know. And of course, the cinema helped me, you see. So like all of my films, this is a film about filmmaking for me personal, right? I mean, like, okay, which are the role models of films which guide me, which are helping my hand, you know? Of course, it was the Italian neorealism.
Yeah, those films are so great with children and cities.
Yeah.
And society's in flux. I really like the way also at the beginning of this film, it's a small world in many ways because this film is set on an island and it's a small community, but then it slowly kind of zooms out. We learn more. And I like the way that you apply that concept to the way that we as an audience experience at first normal life. And then suddenly we realize through little things aren't normal, like that we get the British bombers flying overhead in one scene. And then I think I wrote down somewhere, it's 15 minutes before we see a swastika flag. So even there, and you know, it's quite a shock when you see it in the film for the first time. You think, oh, right, yeah. That's right. We're here. We're in this period.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Zone of Interest came out, I think, a year before I was shooting the film. And I liked the Jonathan Glazer film a lot.
Yeah, which was about, just to remind listeners, this was the film set in the house of the commandant of Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And which was famously right next door to Auschwitz. Yeah. And so that was a film all about normal everyday life while the horrors are happening meters away.
Right. And when you think about this film or in general about Second World War films, they're always very spectacular. I mean, war is a spectacular thing, I know, but I mean, you have the house next to Auschwitz, right? And that's spectacular. You have Saving Private Ryan, a lot of shootings there is spectacular. Schindler's List is spectacular, you know? Pianist is, I don't know, he sees the uprising of the Warsaw Ghetto, the pianist guy, the film by Polanski. So you always have this very spectacular element, but what I was interested in was how was daily life far away from the front? So my house is the opposite of the Auschwitz house. My house is on the farthest western part of the country. That, you know, after my house comes England, right? And between that is the sea. So how do these people deal with the war? You know, how was the daily life in there? What was their challenges? How the war infected them? Is that cinematographic? Can I make a film about that?
But did that did that remind you of any experiences you've actually had yourself? And I'm thinking about coming from a migrant background, perhaps, or even witnessing in your time the fall of the Berlin Wall. Were there any sort of analogous situations that, well, not the same scale of World War II at this point and the end of the Third Reich and all of that, but were there analogous situations that you'd lived through that you thought, ah, it reminds me of that too? And I'm expressing something that I felt in that moment in my life in this World War II story.
What it reminds me is not an experience what I could use in the film, but the world we're living now. I don't know how it's in Australia, but which is far away from here. But here's like the war on Iran affects us here. You know, the prices of the fuel, they go crazy. You see that's what is I'm about, you know. So the effect of the war far away from the front. You see, so we food is getting more expensive, everything is getting more expensive. We cannot travel. I think if I want to fly to Australia now, I cannot use the usual Dubai, I don't know.
Exactly.
You know, I think
no, you can't.
I can go to
yep.
South Africa or whatever.
Mm.
You see, so this is the effect of the war. I don't remember if I had such an experience before. I mean, of course, there was 9/11, and 9/11 changed how you get in a plane forever.
Yeah.
You know, there could be a war over there, far away, but it got an effect on your world. Even back in Ambon, especially in Ambon, you cannot get sugar or honey or wheat. You know, you can't get those things because they're needed in the front.
By the way, have you seen The President's Cake, which is the Iraqi
yes.
film? It reminded
yes.
me so much of this film, which is also about,
yeah.
you know, it's also about a child going to find ingredients, very scarce ingredients.
Yes,
and within the context of a war happening, conflict happening somewhere nearby, but we see it on the periphery. It's quite extraordinary that your film and The President's Cake, you're from Amron and The President's Cake are sort of made around the same time. And they're both quite similar, but dealing with different eras and different countries.
Yeah, they were both in Cannes in the same year. I think they were both in Side Sections. So I consider The President's Cake as a kind of like a cousin film.
Absolutely.
You know, and I can't imagine that the filmmaker of that film is giving interviews and someone asking me, have you seen Amrum, the film?
Well, maybe, but, you know, I would have asked him, but I hadn't seen Amrum before when I interviewed
okay.
him yet. So,
okay,
but it's they're both very similar. But, you know, surely your background, your migrant background is all about this notion that somewhere very distant, something's happening which has, whether it's a relative dying or it's a friend going to jail, certainly, you know, that's having a direct impact on my view of the world, even though it's very distant.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, these the examples are for the role models or the blueprints are, like I mentioned, this is of course Ladri di Bicicletti, the bicycle thieves by De Sica, and in case of Amrum, very much Germany.
Year Zero. Yeah, Rossellini's film.
Year Zero, the Rossellini film. It's about a child in the same age, like in Amrum, and he has kind of like the same, the father is there, but the father is sick, I think, as far as I remember in the film. And so the child is trying to get ingredients for and food for the family.
Yes. Yeah, there's something about seeing cities through children's eyes, which is very compelling. But it's interesting in your film, it's actually seeing more landscape. And it's a contact with nature. And of course, in that there are all these life, very early life lessons about how things work, you know, the violence of nature, the things you need to do to survive. Yeah. All of those moments.
Nature is a very cinematographical element because you work a lot with light, with the real light. You don't put a lamp in there. So in a way you became like a native, you know, you really have to know about the lighting. Especially in Amum, you had the shooting. What was very challenging was the tides.
How big are the tides? How many meters?
They're pretty big. I mean, you can go from one island to the other. You can go from Amrum to the next island, Föhr, when there is the low tide.
Wow.
You see? So, and it took about 90 minutes or 2 hours. You know, you have to be very fast if you want to go back and forth.
Yeah.
Usually what they offer to tourists is going there, stay a night at the other island and walk back.
This is walking 90 minutes. Wow, that's a long walk.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a long walk, you know, but it's a very touristic thing. But what is interesting about the tides is the movement, and it's about time. So you have two cinematographical elements there very much. It's like you have the movement of the water coming and going, which is always very thankful if you put the camera on, you know. Movement is what movies are about.
Yeah,
you know?
It's the wind in the trees is what I always...
The wind in the trees, yeah. Exactly. And then you have, of course, the idea of time.
Mm-hmm.
Because nothing is, I think, as difficult as the using of time in film. Christopher Nolan is pretty good with that, you know. So the using the element of time in film, because you dominate the time. You have to tell your whole life or whatever you have to tell. Or in case of Amrum, a week in... I don't know, I'm almost 90 minutes. In 90 minutes, so you have to control the time. And working with the tides, you see, which is about time, was very much a lesson.
Can you tell me your thoughts on, or your approach to how you wanted to depict the political belief of the mother in the film, especially, who, you know, we should point out is heavily pregnant and, you know, going through a lot of stresses. She's, you know, separated from her husband, obviously. But how you, what you wanted her political fervor to look like?
I wanted to look her political fervor look like fundamentalist religion belief. I know about that. I experienced that. I saw that with people, you know, that religion is, you cannot argue with people. You know, religion has that level, you know, is when you are like fundamentalist, I mean, you know. And it helped to give her or had the fundamentalism as a role model for her in the head. And what we know about the Nazism, I mean, what we know about a lot of political directions and groups, you know, they can be as fundamental as, I don't know, religious fundamentalism, you know, so that they reach a level where you cannot talk about that. I experienced that in a political way when COVID was, you know, suddenly a lot of people in my surrounding, even friends, turn out to believe in conspiracy, you know. Suddenly they came from all over, you know, like, yeah, you too. I mean, I didn't believe, you know, and they were so stuck and stubborn in their belief. You couldn't argue. You cannot argue with them. And I think a lot of people voted the NSDAP like people today vote, I don't know, the Social Democrats, you know, like, or the Christian Democrats, like, maybe it's the better solution. I don't believe that all of them were like Nazis and anti-Semites, you know, but maybe they were because they bought the shit. I mean, they know that this was existing, you know, and no matter what, they vote for them anyway, that causes less empathy. So the experience or the witnessing of fundamental people, like, for to a certain point, even my father, you know, with religion, you know, where you could not argue, you know. I mean, we speak about Islam now, right? And I'm a Muslim too, and I have that from my parents, but the way I believe is maybe more like the way Rumi was giving his opinions or thoughts. Rumi is about tolerance. That's the whole idea of Rumi, right? And the way my father was believing was tolerance was something very far away. But he loved it me, so he tolerated me. And I could sneak my ideas through his love to me in his head. That's Rumi, right? And yeah.
Fadi Akin, it's a wonderful moment to end it on, especially given the themes in your film. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Nice talking to you.
Filmmaker Fadi Akin, his new one, Amram, is screening around the country in the German Film Festival, along with three other films from his career, Goodbye Berlin, Head On, and The Edge of Heaven. Check your guides. Amram is definitely one to catch. You're listening to The Screen Show with me, Jason DeRosso, brought to you by ABC Radio National.
Uno mas, thanks, Ed.
Seem a little down, Johnny. You're normally a little more animated.
Finish him!
One of the most active, if not lucrative, sectors of the Australian film industry involves making movies that don't actually look like they're made here. And that's part of a worldwide trend, offshoring Hollywood production to cities as different as Budapest, Vancouver, or Rome, who all compete to attract these big productions. Mortal Kombat 2 is the latest to come off the local production line. It's made on the Gold Coast, while its 2021 predecessor, which was one of the few box office successes during the pandemic, or, well, just after it, well, that was made in South Australia. Both films are made by my next guest, the same director, and they're a reboot of a franchise inspired by a fantasy video game series about gladiatorial tournaments between Earth-dwelling humans and, well, fighters from other dimensions. But I think the films also feel indebted to a more contemporary trend of ultraviolet black comedy action movies, which began with the still unsurpassed John Wick in 2014. Very indebted, of course, to martial arts movies. Mortal Kombat 2 reintroduces a franchise favourite, a character named Johnny Cage, played by the terrific Kiwi actor Carl Urban, who you can still see in Netflix's, I guess it's a revisionist superhero series, The Boys, but has also played Judge Dredd and Dr. Leonard Bones McCoy in Star Trek. In this reimagining, Johnny Cage is a washed-up former action movie hero who's used to playing tough guys on screen, not so much being one in real life. Or whatever this is. Actually, the film takes place in an unearthly realm, or actually it's realms, full of dank castles and menacing jungles that represent, well, in typical video game fashion, an atmospheric mishmash of martial arts movie and high fantasy. All these amazing sets are conjured by veteran Japanese production designer and occasional Tarantino collaborator Yohei Taneda. But back to Johnny Cage. Fans of the games and fans of the 90s movies will perhaps be surprised by Johnny Cage's over-the-hill vibe, but it's a vibe that Urban, who is far from over the hill, delivers well, with a almost Harrison Ford twinkle in the eye. Eventually, of course, Johnny Cage finds his inner warrior. I wish, though, he'd also found a few better gags along the way in Jeremy Slater's script. Elsewhere, the film's other main storyline is about the childhood trauma and torn allegiances of a noble-born female warrior, Katana, who's from a realm known as Edenia. She's played by the magnetic Hong Kong-born British actor Adeline Rudolph. But enough about plot. Story takes a back seat in Mortal Kombat. The hint is in the name. You watch this for the gory, intricately choreographed fights to the death. What kind of person would direct such a movie not once, but twice? Well, he's an Australian, Simon McCoy, and I met up with him in a Sydney hotel room this week and found myself sitting opposite a very mild-mannered man in a well-cut blue suit and stylish spectacles. He's coming up, followed by Carl Urban and other members of the cast.
You want to know what makes a hero? It's not destiny. It's not something you're born with. It's searching for greatness.
Johnny Cage. You have been chosen for Mortal Kombat.
Then realizing you've had it in you this entire time.
Whoa! I really don't feel comfortable hitting a girl.
Don't worry. You won't.
Yo! Send me back. I want to go back.
The rules of the tournament are simple. Our fates would not be settled by the size of our armies. They would be decided by combat.
Simon McQuoid, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thanks.
Let's talk about Carl Urban in this project. He must have been a big coup in terms of casting, for all he brings in terms of his sort of star persona and his connection to, I guess, action, both on the small screen and the big screen, and fantasy to a degree. Tell me about how you secured him.
Well, it really started when we worked out what type of version of Johnny we were going to have in this film. Because through the decades in Mortal Kombat, Johnny's sort of... he's largely been the same, but there's some different facets to him. And once we realised we wanted what the journey is that we wanted him to have, going from a broken man at the lowest point of his career, things are about as bad as they've gotten, and then we knew the growth would come from that point through our story. To know what Carl has done in his career, but especially I always remembered and always taken with his performance of Bones in the Star Trek films. And what I loved about that is Bones was a potentially on the broader end of the scale, comedically. And what Carl did with that was he grounded that so beautifully. And he allowed it to be funny, but he did it in a very kind of layered, rich, interesting way that just made it really satisfying. So I loved that, and I loved even in his role in the Bourne film where he was the Russian agent. It all comes with a certain nuance and gravitas that I knew he would bring to this. And Johnny Cage in the games is extremely broad. And it had to be someone who understood where the comedy was and also could layer in all those other human emotions to it.
Yeah, tell me about bringing the production to the Gold Coast. Obviously, the first film was made in South Australia. Was there some kind of bidding war behind the scenes between, you know, the two facilities in, you know, securing the second film? How did that play out?
Well, no, there wasn't. It was just led by what was right for the script and what was right creatively. We knew we needed bigger stages because of what we knew we were about to create. And we also knew that we needed jungle and rainforest for those pieces of Edenia that that we go to. So those two things, those two key ingredients led us to the Gold Coast. And, you know, you just hear everyone that works there loves working there. And I now love working there. It's just a joyous place to spend time. I mean, the facilities are great, the crews are great. The facilities and the crew are brilliant in Adelaide and South Australia too. The locations were amazing. But the stages there are very, very... very good, and they worked really well, and it was just effortless working there.
How well do Australian facilities compete when it comes to securing international work like this? Because, you know, as we know, different cities are competing for projects like this all the time, Budapest and Rome, yeah, and Vancouver. And how well do Australian facilities compete?
Oh, they stack up equally or if not better. People love shooting here because the facilities are great and it's that lovely kind of easygoing but incredibly hardworking attitude also that runs through the crews. And I think people really love that. And the stages here, I was in Budapest last year doing something and the stages there were good, but our stages are just as good and some of them are better.
In terms of, I mean, and do we need more? Is there a risk of getting complacent with the degree of competition there is?
Well, the Perth Film Studios have just come on board and they're really, really impressive.
Do you rate them?
Yeah, very, very highly. They are very well planned and created and run. They're really, the people they have in place there are really good. And
in,
so,
in terms of size, how do they compare to, say, the Gold Coast, though?
It's smaller than the Gold Coast, but there's four stages. And they are, I can't remember the square footage on them off the top of my head, but they're sizable. And you could easily make a substantial production out of there, no problem.
How many sound stages did you use for this?
Eight, maybe seven.
That sounds like a lot.
It is a lot. So we use the biggest stage they have there. It's where we set Edenia. We built an entire town on the stage. Went right to the edge everywhere. There was one stage I wish we could have gotten it, but it was their second biggest someone was using it as storage for stuff for a production. And then we used pretty much all of the others. We have to take over, it was one of the smaller ones, but we need one of them just for the stunt team. So when in working with the stunt team, I go and spend time with them there as they go through all the stunts, and they need a big facility as well, shooting all their stuff. So we take up a lot of room.
Simon McQuoid, director of Mortal Kombat 2, which is out in cinemas this week. Now to some cast members, Carl Urban and two Australians, Josh Lawson, who here reprises his post-apocalyptic Aussie psycho called Kano, and Jess McNamee, also back from the first movie as Sonya Blade, a character that's light years from the kind of girls she played in her early career on shows like Home and Away and Packed to the Rafters. Hi, guys. I imagine that when you're working on a film like this, an action film, that you might get to hang out a little bit more than when you're working on a straight drama because of the amount of time you spend in the gym. Is there a lot of that where you're sharing gym facilities?
Really, yeah, it's really the stunt training.
Yeah.
The amount of hours that you're putting into the choreography that you see in the movie it's a lot more than you would think.
I heard that there was like an entire soundstage dedicated to the stunt.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? That's like a gigantic sort of rehearsal space?
Soft pads, boxes everywhere, and they mock up exactly what the set dimensions of the set are, and then that's where you go and rehearse and learn the fight.
And all the wire stunts and everything, it's all like hooked up so that you can, a lot of us had to kind of jump in wires to spin around and do different stunts, and that's all rigged up in there.
What's the ratio of rehearsing to actually shooting these intricate long sequences of, incredibly gruesome fights?
Oh, I'd say it was like 3 to 4 months of rehearsing for, say, a fight that took 2 weeks to shoot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it's basically 50-50 almost in terms of like what you're doing. It depends on your load in terms of, for me, the first movie, it was months and months.
Mm.
Second time around, I don't have as many fights, so it was less. But someone like Carl, is in those stunt rehearsals all the time.
Carl, tell me about coming to this franchise and you, because you're putting a particular spin on Johnny Cage, I think. He's a little bit more sort of world-weary. Have you met a lot of guys like the character you're playing in this movie, guys who are sort of the wrong side of their peak in their career?
Yeah, sure. I mean,
it's not
who are they? Well, it's Carl Urban. yeah, sure. I was able to draw on a lot of, I guess, my own personal experience, people that I've known in the industry and people I've worked with, people I haven't worked with, and then also sort of laid that into, really what was presented to me in the script that was written by Jeremy Slater. And, it's a very sort of specific journey for this character. He starts as a broken man and, it's at that very juncture that he gets called upon to be the best of himself. And I just thought that was a really interesting, fertile, funny place to base a character.
Yeah. Jess, what's it like being a woman on an action movie set? I mean, you're not the first woman to ever go onto an action movie set, but is it a testosterone-fueled kind of...
Yeah. I mean, I did find the first one challenging in that way. I was, like, the only female on that set, and it took it out of me a little bit in the way that it was just very much male dominated, and I had the best time, but it was very nice to have a couple new females on this one. I think it kind of balanced things out a little bit.
Because I was looking on your wiki and thinking, do you have some sort of background as a gymnast or as a kind of, I don't know, amateur MMA?
No, in your team? But thank you. That's very flattering. But I can't take all the credit. I had an amazing stunt double called Zia Kelly who made me look pretty good.
So it was a culture shock in terms of coming to action movies.
Yeah, it was in terms of action movies. In terms of working with males exclusively, that wasn't a shock. Like, that's kind of what the industry has been. Like, I've oftentimes been the only female on a set. I think that's changing a lot now, and I found, you know, I've shot a couple of jobs even since this Mortal Kombat where there've been a couple more females on set, and it has been a shock to the system. I'm like, wow, it's so nice having some female energy around, because oftentimes you can be the only female on a set, and that just is the case.
And it's just better for the entire set.
100%.
I mean, there's no question, not just better for women, I expect it's better for everybody.
100%.
Yeah.
Well, Josh, you've got very big Australian male energy in this film again, bringing that back, I think, quite successfully. I mean, it originally kind of wasn't an Australian, but kind of morphed into an Australian somehow via a bad Cockney accent.
That's what I was told as well. Yeah,
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Sort of a bad Cockney accent in the 90s ultimately led to me being able to play this role.
In the 95 movie?
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
That it was this Cockney accent that people kind of inferred to be Aussie. And then from that point on, they just lent into the Aussiness and went, yeah, maybe you should be Aussie. Mm. And so, but initially he was English, I think.
Who are you thinking of when you're playing this character? Is there some uncle that you're channeling?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, you're right. It's not exactly a person, but rather a generational type of Aussie that, you know, I think of my parents or grandparents' generation he is old-fashioned, I think, in a way. And he lives in a strange universe where, of course, there's this crazy world of Mortal Kombat, where Outworld and Netherrealm and Adenia and all these fantastical places, and yet he'll make references to Magic Mike and Harry Potter. And, you know, so there's a foot in both camps, and I think that sort of wink to the audience makes him endearing, even though he's such a brute. And a selfish one at that, that helps audiences connect with him a bit.
This sense of, you know, action thrillers, and especially in the fantasy realm or semi-fantasy realm, the superhero realm, being increasingly kind of a bit meta and having this ironic wink and all that's kind of becoming more and more important. I'm just thinking about how this might compare to The Boys, Carl, if you think there is any sort of comparison.
In what regard?
In terms of that sense of...
almost breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah, there's a bit of a sense of self-awareness about the genre.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that I enjoyed about this movie is what I made, and this character was, I made the decision to make Johnny a fan of Lord of the Rings. and so he's got his own sort of version of, you know, referencing elements of pop culture that, you know, that are of appeal to him. But, yeah.
But even in the new Mortal Kombat, there's a Homelander. You can play Homelander, I think, from The Boys in the new Mortal Kombat. So there is, I mean, I think what's great about Mortal Kombat is it's always had a bit of a sense of humor about it. You know, even from the early days, it is a wink. The violence is so ultra that I think it crosses into a knowingness, you know, in the game that I think we bring into the film.
And you speak to Ed Boon, the creator, and that... like hearing his stories about how they created, you know, characters, or and that he was voicing characters and just how they came to be. They were all just dudes shooting the shit, you know, in their basement and having the best time doing it. So they don't take themselves too seriously.
Well, so you actually got to meet and discuss. Wow.
Well, he's involved in this second film.
Yeah,
so he wasn't involved in the first, but had come over and got involved in the second. And that's why I think there is a real level up in this one, because he had his fingers in it and was making sure that we were very specific and stuck with the law.
Revenge of the Boys in the Basement.
Yeah.
Right, in a big way.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some of the cast from Mortal Kombat 2, Carl Urban, Josh Lawson and Jess McNamee. Mortal Kombat 2, as I've already said, is out everywhere this week. That's it for another episode of The Screen Show. If you're listening on the pod, I do hope you've also caught up with the new offering in The Screen Show, Podfeed, which is our weekly TV chat with ABC Radio National's TV critic Wenli Ma, called The Couch. Thanks to The Screen Show's producer, Sarah Corbett. Until next week, it's bye from me, Jason DeRosso.
It's showtime.
definitely die.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.